decision. If convicted this time, Hankinson could face a maximum of life in prison. For NPR News, I'm Giselle Roden in Louisville.
In the opening game of the World Series, the Los Angeles Dodgers beat the New York Yankees 6-3 in Los Angeles last night. It ended with the first game-ending grand slam in World Series history by Freddie Freeman in the 10th inning. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
What a gorgeous fall morning we have here on the Augustana College campus. And friends, you're just in time for a conversation with this week's guest, Todd McGreevy from the River City's Reader and other haunts. We'll get to that. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll join us here on Quad Cities Public Radio for local radio, the way it's meant to be brewed on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. And here we are, Todd. I don't even recall how long it is we've known each other. At least 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
At least 30 years. And probably more. But this is my first chance to visit with you in this setting. So thank you, Todd McGreevy, for being here.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
I probably got things wrong on the promo. I'm used to getting things wrong. But I was just referring to you as co-publisher of the River City's Reader. But what titles do you like to use?
Well, technically, I am the chief bottle washer. I mean,
All right.
On the masthead, it says publisher. Yes, yeah. I'm the publisher. My wife, Kathleen McCarthy is the editor.
Okay.
Co-founded the publication. But there's also some good Augustana connections to the River City's Reader.
Many.
You know, Jeff Wickman helped us get started. He was our first calendar editor.
Yep.
Jeff, very famous Kodo player here at
Absolutely.
Augustana
I still College. Keep up with him on Facebook.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And Mike Schultz. Been working for us since issue number 19, I think. Mike and I graduated in 1990 from Augie. He's our arts editor, movie critic, theater, you know, editor.
And one of the finest actors I've ever seen.
He's very talented.
Yeah. Did you see him in the Biloxi Blues when the Mississippi Bend Players did that?
I missed that.
Well, I got to tell you. This goes all the way back to when he was in college. I'm a few years older than you young pups.
Yep.
And so I would still come back to see shows. And they did Amadeus.
Mm.
And he played Mozart.
Oh, wow.
Brad Hoskins.
Yes.
Who I'd also love to get on this show. Yeah. He played Salieri and was flawless.
Yeah.
Then years go by, right? And I don't know if you're familiar with Biloxi Blues, but there's a character in the movie version that was done of that, played by Christopher Walken. So very powerful kind of an actor.
Yeah.
Just, you don't need to know about the character. Just know that Christopher Walken played that guy, right? Well, Mike Schultz comes along and does it even better.
Wow.
Here in a local theater. The guy's amazing. So anyway, plenty of...
So Mike's still with us, thankfully. You know, he can't leave. You know, it was hard to leave with somebody wrapped around your legs or your ankle. And he's a prolific. He generates content every day on our website. In fact, it's funny. We've been using the term what's happening in the Quad Cities for a long time. You know, we've been publishing since 1993.
Yep.
And I noticed you guys have a segment called What's Happening QC, which is kind of cool.
And it's a young fella here named Mark Zyla.
That's
kind of fun.
Yeah. So there's a lot happening in the Quad Cities.
There is a lot.
We're very blessed.
There's more happening than anybody could ever get to. And so one of the gifts of the River Cities Reader is it's got the most comprehensive events calendar that you're going to find anywhere. So I appreciate
we pride ourselves on that for sure. You know, and again, all the credit goes to Mike. And there's over 1,000 listings in the Reader in print. And we're in print monthly. We started in '93. We were monthly for 2 years. And we're actually, when we started, we distributed in Cedar Rapids, Dubuque, Peoria. We were in the River Cities, this area, if you will. And then after 2 years of that, we decided to rein in geographically our distribution. We went weekly. and we were weekly for 13 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's a grind.
That is a grind.
Yeah, and then 2008 happened, and the economy kind of collapsed on everybody, and we had to rein our horns in. We went to bi-weekly every other week for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, and then we faded into monthly now, but the internet still updated every day, and so there's still lots of activity.
Well, one of the things I want to get to during our time together is to talk about the evolution of journalism and local media, local everything that you do. But it is interesting, behind that is the business, right? Mm-hmm. So there's the coverage and the mission and all that. But before we get to how that's evolved, let's go back to the beginning with you and your spouse and partner. Mm-hmm. What was it that gave you the notion or the gumption that this is something not only that might be needed, but it was feasible?
Well, it's an origin story. I'll try and be brief.
It's public radio time. You don't have to be brief.
I was living in downtown Davenport. Yeah. I moved back here after went to China for 6 months, lived in Taiwan and in mainland China after graduating from Augustana, and wanted to pursue an art career, painting, sculpture. So I moved to downtown Davenport and had a loft. That was my goal. You know, that's another great thing about the Quad Cities, great old buildings. You know, you could never afford to live in a loft in Chicago. You know, here you could.
Yeah.
And another Augustana grad, Betsy Mowry, introduced me to a young man whose name escapes this minute, who did not go to Augie, but he walked up into the loft that I was living in, which used to be the Lutke print shop. It was a print shop, so there's pica poles everywhere and font books and all this stuff. And he looked around and he said, "This would make a good newspaper office." And we're like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "I published the student newspaper in Missouri State. You know, we should start it."
Yeah,
so Pete Scro, good friend of mine, went to high school with, was living with me at the time, a musician, and we started a newspaper and we called it The Sophist.
I remember that.
And that was out for about 2 or 3 months, and then we changed the name to The Slowfish.
And I remember that.
Yes. And here's another little sidebar for you. I actually laid out The Slowfish paper in the basement of Old Main. I had graduated, and I befriended the editor at the time. I can't remember his name again. I apologize, of the Observer. He gave me a key to the tech lab, whatever you want to call it, and I used the computers there with PageMaker. Aldous PageMaker, and I self-taught myself how to lay out the paper in the basement of Old Main. So that was I think I can say this now 30-plus years later, that statute limitations is over.
No, I'm not worried about that at all. That's an amazing – and now Slowfish was a lot of music coverage, do I recall correctly?
Music and art, visual arts were a big thing for us. And I was the art side, and Pete was the music side, and we dabbled in politics back then. Kai, literally, Pete and I didn't even know what a Democrat or Republican was.
That's how apolitical
we were.
Yeah.
When
you came to this community because of Augustana, but where did you grow up?
Peoria and Chatham, Illinois.
Oh, okay.
Central Illinois.
All right. Yeah. Now, how did this community ever come on your radar screen?
We were recruited to play soccer here.
Mm,
yeah.
All right.
Augustana sent a very eloquent recruiter to our high school one day.
Yeah.
And she recruited A.J. Wakazer and I to come up here. He went to Augustana as well.
Yeah.
And we came and played soccer. And I actually, for 2 years after I graduated, I was assistant coach.
I've forgotten about that.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that's
so,
right.
Augie has a lot of good memories for me.
Well, great.
Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah, yeah.
What is it about the Quad Cities that, I mean, it just happens that this week, Visit Quad Cities had its annual Destination QC party, which is a great love fest.
Mm-hmm.
And they're unveiling this new campaign where one of the threads is, I mean, which we kind of take for granted, that we call ourselves the creative capital of the Midwest. And I think we have the creds to back that up. But what is it about this community? I mean, you could have gone all over the place. In fact, you did. You went to China, right? Mm-hmm. What is it about this place that gets your foot caught in the door?
Well, you know, I was on the one of the founding members of Midcoast Fine Arts, and we did a campaign called the Midwest Arts Mecca. That was a brand we tried to establish as well. So what about it? There's you're a big fish in a small pond here. All right, is one way to look at it. Also, I'll never forget the day I decided I wanted to live here, and it was standing in front of the LeClaire Park Band Shell at a blues festival with my friends, hanging out. The water, the river's right there. The sun is shining. The music's great. I thought, I'm going to live here. This is going to be great. You know, I mean, it's one of these things. There's so much to do here as far as the arts, the bike trails. You know, there's two national bike trails that crisscross here.
Right.
You know that, right?
Right.
The American Discovery Trail and the Great River Trail. This is the only place those two cross from.
Right.
You know,
we are the national east to west crossing of the Mississippi.
Right here.
So, and I was just thinking, you got my memories churning. Depending on the year and the day, you could have been listening to a great blues legend.
Oh, absolutely.
Some of those festivals were just
ahead of their time.
Yeah, God bless Ellis Kell.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that was. Yeah, Ellis befriended me as well when we started the Slow Fish. He was working at the Dispatch at the time, and even though he was a quote, other newspaper, and he didn't care. He's like, "Hey, this is for the music. Let's support each other." So
I think I wrote for the Slow Fish or something.
You probably did, yeah.
Something about the symphony.
Yes, yeah. You probably
did. Under a pen name, so I shouldn't probably be talking about it. So what am I doing?
Anyway, I was doing the Slow Fish, and there was a place called Uncle Roscoe's Polo Club up on Washington Street in Central Davenport.
Yeah,
and I had sold a sculpture to Ross that he hung above the bar, and I used that money to pay for the first issue of the Slow Fish.
My goodness.
And so Ross was dating a woman named Peggy Bernard at the time, and Peggy's best friend that she grew up with was Kathleen McCarthy, and I met Kathleen there at Uncle Roscoe's.
Wow.
And the rest is history.
Man, those were some heady days.
Yes, yes.
I remember I did some experimental theater in those days in that neighborhood. There was a theater somewhere near there.
Okay.
It was, I think, on Washington.
Yeah.
Or Marquette. That's, I don't know. Somewhere
the old
in that
Turner
area.
Hall, the old German I gymnasium think,
yeah,
was what it was.
Right,
that
right.
Turned into,
yeah.
He had the Rathskeller in the basement, he called it. And we had Electric Hellfire Club, and the poster children would play up in the gymnasium. It was good stuff.
Well, how did all of this then, and I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but this came from a sort of an arts perspective.
Yes, yes.
And at a time when there are not many papers that were around and when was the first issue?
93.
In 93, that are still around today.
Right.
And
right.
still vibrant and meaningful.
Yeah.
What is it about your evolutionary story? And we'll get into more granularity later, but how do you credit the fact that this has stuck around and become still more relevant as time goes by?
Well, because we have a great staff member, Mike Schultz, number one. He's a key heavy lifter there. Two, we're blessed with the advertisers we have. We're a free publication. We publish 15,000 copies every month, distributed in over 350 locations on both sides of the river. It's something we're very passionate about. It's frankly, we probably wouldn't be able to sleep at night if we didn't have this outlet to get some ideas out there and issues out there. I mean, for instance, would be the September edition. I don't know if you saw this or not, but when RFK made his speech August 23rd, leaving the Democrat Party and endorsing Donald Trump. Did you hear the speech by chance?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it's 48 minutes. It's a riveting. It's the most surgical, excoriating takedown of the mainstream narrative I've ever heard.
Hmm.
It's so good. And I was talking to maybe our mutual friend, Ezra Sidran, who writes for us every now and then, and does a lot of FOIA requests about the city of Davenport.
Yep. Yep.
And I asked him about RFK, what he thought of his speech, and he was very derisive of him. And I said, wait a second, have you even heard his speech? And he said, no. I said, it triggered me to go, I'm going to go publish that speech. It's so good. And I went and found a transcript of it and listened to it while I read the transcript. It was dead on. And it is riveting. And that's the type of thing that makes things fulfilling for us to do, is put this kind of information out there that just breaks through the narrative and gets people to one of the things I learned at Augustana College with some of the teachers, professors out here, is critical thinking skills.
Right.
And that's what we hope to engender with our readers, is use your critical thinking skills.
Right. Before we dive deeper into the reader, you have other things going on, because I'm always interested in the things that you are doing. Marigold Resources is a sort of a communications and marketing firm. And,
well, no, not well, quite. The communications marketing firm I had was called Atmospheres.
Oh, Atmospheres.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah.
And is why I need the update. Tell me about how it all pieces together.
So Atmospheres started when I was with Midcoast Fine Arts at the Quad City Airport in a meeting going over the art gallery they were going to install.
Yeah.
And I was there as a volunteer to help with that process. Midcoast Fine Arts and Quad City Arts partnered on that gallery out there. Dean Schroeder designed it and so forth. Beautiful gallery. Great exhibit out there right now. It's phenomenal. And after the meeting, I heard one of the staff members at the airport say, what are we going to do about the advertising out here? And then they didn't have anybody to sell the ads on the company in Dallas that was doing it. They were going to let them go because they were redoing an $18 million upgrade and all this stuff. And I've actually went in, pitched myself as a publisher of the Reader. I said, I know how to sell advertising. I'll do your ads at the airport. And I said, I'll start a sister company. And I actually had a ballot. I had three different names, and I gave it to the airport staff, and they all voted on it. And they voted Atmospheres.
That's where Atmospheres.
That's where Atmospheres came
ADMOS.
From.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Because then you got into bus wraps and
after
all
that,
kinds of
started
cool
getting
stuff.
Into the transit authority with Metrolink and then City Bus. And to this day, Atmospheres still manages some of the buses in Bettendorf for advertising. So there's a there was a side hustle that helped keep the Reader alive.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
But Marigold is more like the parent.
Nope, Marigold is totally separate.
Or just real estate?
Nope, it's not real estate. We're business brokers. Okay. M&A advisors, Kai. See, mergers and acquisitions.
I didn't take any classes in the business department.
Yeah, neither did
so
I.
This is all unknown to me.
I didn't even go into Sorensen when I was here. Chris Barnard and I started, Marigold Resources in 2011. October 2011, yeah. And we're a low to mid-market M&A firm. We help people buy and sell businesses throughout Nebraska, Iowa, and Illinois. And I spend about probably 75% of my time is on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's fulfilling, great work, help people with transitions.
Well, for somebody who doesn't know anything about what you just said, I think I know what the M and the A stand for. But, I mean, is there an anecdote you can give us? We don't want to give away anything that's proprietary, but could you give us an example of a Marigold project?
Oh, sure. Well, you ever heard Teske's Pet?
Sure,
we helped,
sure,
we helped the family sell that business year and a half ago. You've heard of Wirtz Funeral Home? We helped sell Wirtz Funeral Home.
Yeah.
You caught me flat-footed here. KVF Quad Corp, the powder coating company, across from Deer Harvester Works. We helped sell that. I mean, we've helped all kinds of people. We sold CT Products recently, a millwright and a fabrication company in West Davenport. We just sold a business in Northern Iowa. We sold a porta potty company in Des Moines. I mean, we sold pharmacies. You name it. We sold a lot of different things.
Well, that's cool.
You name it.
Yeah. Well, now, okay, so you mentioned you didn't take any business classes. Where did all this stuff come from? Just being insatiably curious?
You know, it's interesting you'd ask that question because today happens to be my father's birthday. Rest his soul, all right? And I literally, at Augustana College, I'll never forget the phone being on the wall with the cord.
Yep.
And his business had a 1-800 number, and I got my lessons on business from him on that phone.
Really?
Yeah, he helped buy and sell his business twice while he was working for a rolling machinery company. So
my goodness.
Once to the Japanese and once to the English private equity companies. And so I, by osmosis, learned, on that phone, some of these standards, yes.
Well, I was going to say, and one of the reasons that I've really been looking forward to today is not only are you one of the smartest people I know, you're also one of the reasons I really respect you is you're just curious. And I've often found that something happens when we stop being curious, right? And think that we know something about something, right? And that trips us up. And so I'm grateful to have you here because I am curious and our listeners are curious. We always want to know about this day in music. So we're going to step aside for just a second and make way for the composer's datebook.
This is the Composer's Datebook for October 26th. I'm John Burge. On today's date in 1930, The Age of Gold, a new ballet by the Soviet composer Dmitri Shostakovich, opened in Leningrad. At that time, it was trendy for Soviet art to extol sporting events and contrast the wholesome values of the new Soviet society with those of the decadent bourgeois West. And so the plot of this new Soviet ballet ran as follows. A Russian soccer team arrives in a Western city to play a match during an industrial exposition, only to find their heroic endeavors thwarted by a hostile hotel staff, a seductive Western opera diva, and, of course, corrupt police and city officials. Dutifully following the party line, Shostakovich wrote, "Throwing it to contrast the two cultures was my main aim. The dances for the Europeans breathe the decadent spirit of contemporary bourgeois culture. But I tried to imbue the Soviet dances with the wholesome elements of sport and physical culture." One of the lasting hits of his ballet score was a sardonic little polka. Despite all this political subtext, Shostakovich seemed to be having a whale of a time, as if he rather enjoyed spending a little time, if only musically, in the decadent West. Composer's Datebook is produced by APM, American Public Media, in collaboration with the American Composers Forum, reminding you that all music was once new.
And support for Composer's Datebook on WVIK comes from the Quad Cities Symphony Orchestra, where access meets inspiration. The QCSO seeks to inspire, entertain, and engage the entire Quad Cities community through music, music education, and cultural leadership. You can learn more at qcso.org, especially information on the Hocus Pocus concert and then our upcoming November Masterworks concert. You won't want to miss. It is going to be a full-on production of Felix Mendelssohn's concert piece for Midsummer Night's Dream. And my guest, Todd McGreevy, I'm going to sell you on it too. It's great because Mendelssohn wrote a version of this where it's not an opera, but you've got voices singing the parts. And if you know the play that he was inspired by, you hear the spirits going through the enchanted forest and all this kind of stuff. So it's a really big treat. And I think the first time Quad City Symphony Orchestra patrons will hear tabla music in Adler Theater Saturday night, or tonight, rather, I should say. No, wait, no, that's next week. I'm already a week ahead of myself. November 1st, and then November, that's the 2nd, the 3rd, Sunday in Centennial Hall. And I know we've heard tabla music in Centennial Hall,
but
this will be kind of a fun thing. So again, my guest is Todd McGreevy, publisher of the River Cities Reader, and we are going all over the map on stuff. We're talking about...
Well, I like the term you use, being curious. Kathleen, our editor, has written numerous times how frustrating it is when people are incurious.
Yeah.
That's definitely an anathema to what we're trying to – we want to be very curious about things, and we ask a lot of questions. And sometimes people say we ask too many questions. So,
The popular television series Ted Lasso, I don't know if you've ever seen it. You should see it because it's a lot about soccer and the beauty of soccer. But I love it so much. I went and watched it twice. And there's an episode where he credits this very profound saying to Oscar Wilde. Did a little research. Oscar Wilde never said it. And the saying is this, be curious, not judgmental. And the more I think about that, it's right, because when you are curious, it is much harder to be judgmental.
Yes.
And by the same token, when you cease to be curious, it's very easy to become judgmental. And
that's
a journey that I think a lot of us are on. And I'm grateful for the trails you blaze on that. So we talked a little bit about RFK, and that's in the context of the current presidential election. What are the things you're looking forward to? And I don't want predictions, because I'm so sick of every headline story says fill in the blank will be key to this election. I'm not talking about prognostication.
I'm looking for it to be over.
I'm looking forward to it be over as well. But I mean, what are some of your observations? It is certainly unprecedented.
Oh yeah, it is. It's a wild ride right now. It's craziness going on. And to be totally blunt, we kind of eschew national politics. This RFK piece is an outlier for us, because, you know, we don't really go with the national stuff very often. We tend to focus on the county politics.
Yes. Well, then let's talk about that.
Yeah. I'm a firm believer that the most important ballot you cast is who your county sheriff is. That's the most important ballot you cast, vote you cast, in my view, because, as you might understand, I'm a big property rights person. I'm a big Bill of Rights person. We like to protect the Bill of Rights and property rights. Your body's your property. You know, your speech is your property. What your physical holdings are your property. And the sheriff is the executor of the laws in the county. And without a good sheriff, you can have your property rights removed. So that's why we think it's very important. And we always, before each primary and before each general election, we send a series of questions typically to the sheriff, the auditor, and the people running for supervisor. We focus on those races primarily. And in the current issue that's on the stands right now, issue number 1026, we have a questionnaire for the there's two supervisor positions in Scott County up on the ballot this time. There's five people running. Two Republicans, one Democrat, and two independents are running. And we asked a series of questions of those candidates. We also have a county sheriff race, Republican and Democrat running there, and an auditor race. And so we asked those. And the second most important elected office, in my personal view, since you asked, is the auditor.
Well, and just so if folks are listening, in Iowa, the auditor is the chief elections official. The corollary in Illinois is the clerk. And I would assume you're extending it to, if you were thinking in an Illinois context, the clerk would be the second highest.
Yep. Yeah. Right. And they're in Iowa, the county auditor takes the role of election commissioner. during the election cycles, and it's like there's a whole statute about election commissioners, if you will. But the auditor also is in charge of all the plat books, all the record keeping for the courts, all the record keeping for all the other offices in the county, managing all the budgets, doing all the payroll. I mean, if you look at the list of what the auditor does, it is huge. And our mutual friend Mark Nelson ran in the primary for auditor this cycle.
Talk about sheriffs a little bit, and I agree that that's a hugely important role. My own perspective is, and I don't follow Scott County as closely, but we've been very fortunate in Rock Island County. The last two folks have been law enforcement professionals who I think have a deep respect and appreciation for process, responsibility, and all that kind of thing. The irony is, and so, I mean, I say that, I just want to preface it, I have high regard for our current sheriff, Darren Hart, his predecessor, Jerry Bustos, but there's no educational or professional certification requirement to be the sheriff. And many years ago, and I'm not going to name a name, but it was when you and I were children, there are stories of a sheriff in Rock Island County, it was the opposite of the kind of person that we have today. And this speaks to another concern I have, and that is I have a cousin who's a cop in Sweden.
Okay.
So he had to go to training for in a national training center for a year, and that's recently gone up to 18 or 24 months, where there's a centralized national curriculum in order to become a police officer. And of course, the way American history has unfolded, and we don't like to change things that we trace back to the 1700s, is if a couple of guys like that guy is your law. And still to this day, I mean, we just saw the case in Springfield where a person who'd been let go, who'd been fired by several other law enforcement agencies was able to get, you know, a job, and probably should not have have gotten the job. So that is something that's a point of sensitivity for me. I think we'd be better served if we had a routinization of professionalism and education for the people on whom we rely so much.
Yeah, we've been fortunate on both sides of the river with sheriffs and our adulthood here in the Quad Cities. All the candidates who have participated on both sides of the river from both parties have always answered our questions, in my view, very effectively and satisfactorily. They're all pretty much on the same page.
Yeah.
There's some nuances around the corners, around the edges of things. But for the most part, we have really good opportunities for sheriffs here.
Yeah. But it's important that we pay attention to these local races. So I'm totally on board with you on that. Yeah. And it is a concern. And this is why I'm glad to have you, Todd, is that in my tenure, I'm an elected member on the Rock Island County Board, and in my tenure there, I've watched the skinnying down of local journalism such that we almost never have a reporter in our meetings. And as a former reporter myself, maybe I'm too sensitive to it, but there is an appreciable distinction in the way public officials behave when there's a reporter in the room versus when there isn't a reporter in the room. And my bias is we behave better when there's a reporter in the room. And it makes me a little bit worried that there's never a reporter in the room anymore.
Yeah. For years, we advocated to have the video cameras on in the county board meetings. And they wouldn't do it. And then when COVID happened, they had to go to the and it stuck, thankfully. And so that helps, I think, when they know they're being recorded.
I think that we may want to revisit that and look into it. I don't have any fundamental opposition to it, other than the fact that you and I both know a couple of city councils where we're during public comment, it's like, hey, this is my moment, baby.
Oh, goodness.
I'm on CCTV.
Yes,
about 100 of my friends.
Well, in Scott County, there's actually technically not a public with business on the agenda.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is in Rock Island County.
There is. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. We have public comment in every meeting and also for the Rock Island City Council.
Yes.
The difference is Rock Island City Council does they used to broadcast, but now cable has kind of so it's just to your laptop. I mean, you go to the website and you can watch the live proceedings.
Yeah.
But when it was on public access, there were some moments when people would just they would take that
showboat a little bit.
The soapbox and hold on to it for a while.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because for years a guy named his last name was Weber. I think it was Joel Weber. I think is his name. He would go to the city council meetings in Davenport meticulously and ask them to investigate the hydrofluorosilic acid in the water supply, also known as fluoride.
Yeah.
And everybody called him nuts, you know. But he would meticulously go there every time and just continue to read. And I write about a gentleman by the name of Michael Angelos in the current issue on the stands who passed away this May. The title is called An Oasis of Liberty. Michael Angelos and a bunch of us started a group called Super Liberty years ago. And we would meet in the basement of the Davenport Public Library and have just open meetings for people to share ideas about what's happening, for being activists, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we started we brought the Dr. Paul Connett Jr. here in the Quad Cities to speak at the Moline Library and Bettendorf Public Library. This is about a year after we talked about getting the Rock Island water just a minute ago. There was the hydrofluoric acid. Do you know what it is? It's what comes off of the scrubbers of aluminum and coal scrapings, if you will. And it captured in the air, and they put it in our water supply as a additive for fluoride for your teeth.
So how does it differentiate from fluoride?
It's an actual neural toxin is what it is. And what happened in Rock Island, I can actually pull up the video and show you if you want me to, but Channel 8 reported on it, and they had a spill of the hydrofluoric acid at the water supply company, and they had to have three hazmat teams come to take care of it. That's how toxic this stuff is. The reason I'm even bringing all this up is that in the current issue on the stands, there's a federal court ruling that just happened in California that's been 7 years being litigated for 7 years. That's in this issue. And Joel Weber came to Public with Business. That's the reason I'm even bringing this up.
No.
You know, he would be thrilled that this is happening
right
now. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and again, we live in a time now where science has become politicized. Right. I was just reading in The Economist last week that some really smart people took a look at something like 1800 or 1900 national policies or rules all over the developed world to rein in carbon production. Because for a long time it was politicized, does our production of carbon beyond the Earth's ability to absorb it, does that affect climate? And that was a huge fight for a long, long time. Most of the scientific consensus is that, if you put too much carbon in the environment, you're going to get climate change and you're going to get severe weather. Well, what these guys did was they tried to depoliticize, and they found that most of those, let's say, 1800 provisions that they studied were relatively ineffective. They didn't do anything, really. But 60 of them did. And in fact, in aggregate, the 60 reduced carbon emissions into the environment at a level that was about equivalent to what France does, right? So that's an appreciable difference. And if we can agree that less carbon being dumped into the atmosphere is a good thing, and I know not everyone does, but that's what the science says. Then the problem is, okay, well, we've got these 60 solutions that have been given some proof that they work, but yet you're going to have people who say, well, no, that doesn't fit with my politics, so I won't even consider one of the 60. And I imagine that's just flipping something like what you're talking about on its head. There's this consensus that some fluoride has a public health benefit, but of course, like any chemical, if it's too condensed and concentrated, then it's going to be hugely dangerous. But it's going to be interesting to see how this federal court, and I'm grateful that the River Cities Reader is reporting on the federal court ruling and see where it goes from there.
Yeah, the verdict is a significant loss for the EPA and the promoters of fluoridation, like the American Dental Association, this article says, because the court found that their claims of safety made for more than 75 years were in fact not supported by evidence.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that worries me, is that when we don't examine these things, you often find that the reason behind is somebody's getting filthy rich.
Yeah, there's that too.
You know,
there's
and if you too. Can find
yeah,
out who that
the
is.
Money.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I mean, would you, I don't know, I'd love your comment on this. Political discourse has gotten so ugly since 2016. What happened in 2016? Well, anyway, it's gotten really ugly, right? And people saying that there's a Jewish space laser agency or stuff like this, that's absolutely nonsensical. That was Marjorie Taylor Greene, by the way.
Oh, okay.
It's nonsensical, but people like that find out that if I say that, my donations skyrocket.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's where I get to look at where the money is, you know, who's making a killing off of stuff like
that. Well, you know, you said that earlier the science has become politicized, and that's one of the reasons why we took such a hard look at this. I mean, we've covered this fluoridation issue.
You've been talking about it for years.
Yes,
I know.
I mean, Jeff Ignatius, my former managing editor for 13 years, looked at it, read the book. I mean, he's even more skeptical than I am, all right? And he felt that it was worth covering as well. And the reason I even bring this up again is that when we tried to get this, the local community to look at this, and just the city of Davenport, all we did it was say, hey, let's look at the four corners of the actual contract from 1953 when we started fluoridating the water supply here. It was called sodium fluoride back then, and it had metrics for how it would be measured. And what's happened since then? How do we get to the neurotoxin being put in the water? And we're not saying take it away. We're just saying let's reexamine the contract.
Sure.
Is it being followed? Let's look at the four corners of the contract. And what we said to people then was this should be an apolitical discussion. If we can't talk about what's in our water supply, what we're bathing with, cooking with, drinking, and have an open dialogue about that, then we're doomed. We're not going to be talking about anything.
So what's blocking that conversation?
I'll tell you what blocked it back then was that the city council said there's not enough of you. They literally told us there's not enough people banging our door down about this to make it an issue. Yeah. Sorry, go away. Yeah. Yeah. You're a bunch of conspiracy theorists. You know, no, we're not conspiracy theorists. This is fact. This is a real problem.
Yeah.
When it spilled at the Rock Island water treatment plant, they had to have three hazmat teams come because it was burning a hole in the ground. That's what you're putting your water supply.
Rock Island or Moline?
Rock Island.
Oh, okay. Because I thought you had said Moline earlier. But yeah.
So anyway, it's science should not be political is what I'm trying to say. And when you talk about carbon, we're probably going to disagree on that one because I'm a fan of CO2. I think we need it for a more verdant earth.
Well,
I love trees. So.
Well, just like too much fluoride can create a spill, too much carbon can create disaster, right? And I mean, I think we would have a serious difference of opinion if you don't think weather patterns are getting rather more severe.
Well, there's a whole story we can talk about that too,
of
if you
course.
Like, because that's going to be on the cover of next month's issue.
All right,
we're hitting all the notes here. Yeah.
Well, and I don't mean to get into granularity but
that's all right.
The whole point is, if you can look at a scientific data set, and then you find two conclusions that are vehemently opposed. I often then look at who's making money off of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to look far to see who's making money off of more carbon being produced and dumped in. Well, one of the largest interest sectors in America is the oil industry, right? And so they can't continue to have their business trajectory go if people are saying, I'm sorry, but we're not going to burn as many carbon units as we used to. That's a very threatening thing to the bottom line. So, I mean, you don't think there's profit in oil?
Oh, there's profit big time. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, and then everything that oil then spins off.
I think we're going to have a fundamental disagreement because it's almost like you breathe, therefore you must pay. You know, we all exhale CO2 all the time. I mean, this is... It's natural. It's not.
And I'm not so much worried about CO2. I'm worried more about carbon monoxide.
Okay, well, that's critical. That's
right. it is critical.
Yes.
And I've actually talked to somebody about this before. Of course, water is critical. But if I completely surround you in it, it's going to be lethal, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, fair point.
Exactly. Yeah. But those are the kinds of things that that you bring to light, and I'm grateful that you do. And but there, you know, there's other things that we have to be aware of in our universe right now. And one of them is the World Series is getting underway. And once again, the team that you and I probably grew up cheering for is long ago gone on winter vacation. Were you a Cubs or a Cardinals fan? Because Peoria's on the brink.
Yeah, my friends were, it was half and half.
Well, we were here, at least in Rock Island, Cubs fans because we got WGN.
Yes.
Our first two cable channels were TTW and GN.
Yes.
And so when I was about 12, I could give you on any given day of the week the batting averages of Ivan De Jesus and Larry Boa and all these different guys.
Sure.
But of course, you can only take so much disappointment. And yes, they went in 2016. But this is the time of year my heart always comes back to a favorite song by a poet and a prophet who had to leave us too young, Steve Goodman. And so for today's Saturday morning jam, if I can make the buttons work in the right direction, it's time for that occasional here. And Wooten used to play this all the time.
Okay.
All right. This is
Don approved.
Don approved. Steve Goodman's A Dying Cub Fan's Last Request.
By the shores of old Lake Michigan, where the hawk wind blows so cold, an old Cub fan lay dying in his midnight hour, the toll. Round his bed, his friends had all gathered. They knew his time was short. And on his head they put this bright blue cap from his all-time favorite sport. Told him it's late, it's getting dark in here, and I know it's time to go. But before I leave the lineup, boys, there's just one thing that I'd like to know. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free, and the doormat of the National League. Told his friends, you know the law of averages says anything will happen that can. That's what it says. But the last time the Cubs won a National League pennant was the year we dropped the bomb on Japan. The Cubs made me a criminal, sent me down a wayward path. They stole my youth from me, that's the truth. I'd forsake my teachers to go sit in the bleachers in flagrant truancy. And then one thing led to another, and soon I discovered alcohol, gambling, dope, football, hockey, lacrosse, tennis, but what do you expect when you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush them like so many paper beer cups, year after year after year, after year after year after year after year after year, till those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L tracks to eat. He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore before my eternal rest. You have your pencils and your scorecards ready, and I'll read you my last request. He said, give me a doubleheader funeral in Wrigley Field on some sunny weekend day, no lights. Have the organ play the national anthem, and then a little na-na-na-na, hey-hey-hey, goodbye. Make six bullpen pitchers carry my coffin, and six groundskeepers clear my path. Have the umpires bark me out at every base in all their holy wrath. It's a beautiful day for a funeral. Hey, Ernie, let's play too. Somebody go get Jack Brickhouse to come back and conduct just one more interview. Have the Cubbies run right out into the middle of the field. Have Keith Moreland drop a routine fly. Give everybody two bags of peanuts and a frosty malt, and I'll be ready to die. Build a big fire on home plate out of your Louisville Slugger baseball bats and toss my coffin in. Let my ashes blow in a beautiful snow from the prevailing 30-mile-an-hour southwest wind. When my last remains go flying over the left field wall, we'll bid the bleacher bums adieu. And I will come to my final resting place out on Waveland Avenue. The dying man's friends told him to cut it out. They said, stop it, that's an awful shame. He whispered, don't cry, we'll meet by and by near the Heavenly Hall of Fame. He said, I've got season's tickets to watch the Angels now. So it's just what I'm gonna do. He said, but you, the living, you're stuck here with the Cubs. So it's me that feels sorry for you. And he said, oh, play that Lonesome Losers tune. That's the one I like the best. Closed his eyes and slipped away. Scotty, it was the dying Cub fans' last request, so here it is. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride.
Steve Goodman and a Dying Cub fan's last request, a classic. Saturday Morning Jam on WVIK is underwritten by the League of Small Batch Conversations. In this age of AI chat, make sure to look for the genuine League label so you can be confident the conversation you're listening to is authentically handcrafted in the finest artisanal traditions of locally sourced coffee klatch. Like a heart-to-heart with your mom, only with less guilt. The League of Small Batch Conversations, we're listening. And my guest is the one and only Todd McGrew. Sorry, that was one of the longer underwriting credits.
I love
credits.
That. We're going to have to appropriate some of that for in the reader, the League of Small Batch
Conversations. Well, these are very discerning organizations. They don't spend their underwriting money just anywhere, that's why we try to take care of them any way that we can. Todd McGreevy, the publisher of the River Cities Reader, thanks for being here. You know, it strikes me, there are so many things that you and I could conceivably talk about, but I want to be mindful of the fatigue that you and I have and so many have in the days leading up to a national election.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, we've heard so many things on so many issues. And I know the reader's not often into the national political scene, but even locally, I mean, I got to be part of a candidates forum sponsored by the Rock Island County NAACP, in which local candidates were there. And, you know, there's still some question about the efficacy of the 2020 election. At some point, I think you have to agree to a certain set of ground rules. And you do that. And you can challenge, like an umpire's call, and say, hey, I want that under review. But if the review comes back that, well, this is the way it's going to be, it just it really burns me that some people, and it was still apparent at this candidates forum just a month ago, that there are still some people who I don't like reality, so I'll make my own. Is that something you have to confront?
Well, now, you know, I think you're talking about the election in 2020 that some people still think it was rigged. That's what you're referring to, correct?
Well, there are these assertions of massive voter fraud.
Yeah.
And they've been challenged in court. And the beautiful irony is the last six nationally reported stories of voter fraud were by members of the party that most claims the voter fraud. You know, Colorado, Northwest Iowa, you know, these kinds of things.
Well, actually, people like to quote that there's 60 cases, you know, ruled that there was no widespread evidence of widespread fraud, you know, which is kind of its own little misnomer. I mean, there wasn't evidence of widespread. There might have been a little bit. It was just the tip, you know. But those cases never made it to court. They were never adjudicated, Kai. They were all dismissed on technical grounds, no standing. In fact, when the Trump administration filed their first lawsuit in Georgia right after that election, the Secretary of State and the state law said that they had to adjudicate that, and they threw it out. They didn't even let it get adjudicated. So there's there hasn't been a real deep dive on actually what happened because it's never been adjudicated.
Some of the elements of it have. And what I'm getting at is there hasn't been substantiation that holds up in a legal setting that would allow for the process to proceed. I mean, so in other words, the precedent that I find very troubling is anything that doesn't go my way is clearly rigged and unfair. Mm-hmm. And I think it is safe to say that, you know, we've only one party has won the popular vote for going on a couple of decades now, right? And yet I rebel against anyone who says the answer is throw out the Electoral College, you know, because when the Electoral College result is different than the popular vote, that's always a point of pressure. And yet the Electoral College is something that was put in place. So we have to be very, very thoughtful.
Yeah.
It's just I don't see that level of thoughtfulness about saying, hey, I don't like the way this decision came down. So I will say that it's fake and it's flawed and doesn't really bear my concern.
Well, we cover this issue about election integrity a lot in the River Cities Reader.
Sure.
Kathleen has studied this thoroughly. And in September, we asked a lot of questions. Who has access and or control of county election data before, during, and after an election? And we put this whole – I encourage people to check it out online at our website, rcreader.com. We talk about thumb drives, the voter roll cleanup. Have you ever heard of a company in Spain called CYTL? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a fact that – our Secretary of State is sending the data that all the 99 counties in Iowa send for the results to a server in Spain before it's even brought back down to the Iowa Secretary of State. That's been confirmed. There's all kinds of questions. And unfortunately, all these questions we asked went unanswered by our current auditor, Kerry Tompkins.
Well, I mean, my Ken is with Illinois. And when I was still recently out of college and maybe in college, I was an election judge. And I've asked about the process. I don't see how that relates to Illinois because the physical the machine tabulates at the site, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And then that is recorded both digitally and in paper. Mm-hmm. And both are taken, right? And I think those are tabulated and reported on at the Rock Island County office building. I don't know of anything in any point in the process where those results leave Rock Island County before they are then processed to the state of Illinois. And if anything goes haywire in between, we go back and look at what the state of Illinois says they got from us versus what we got from them.
And if like getting tongue-tied there, sorry. The woman that's in Colorado, Tina Peters, recently was sentenced to 9 years in prison because she made a copy of the election data before she sent it to the Secretary of State in Colorado and backed it up. So she had a backup of what was sent so that when the results came back through the whole state that she could test and see did they get modified in transit.
And I don't know the particulars of the case, but my understanding is she did a little more than that. It wasn't just a procedural error. She was attempting to find evidence that would support the claims of her party. It was a partisan issue. Her party made claims of fraud.
Yeah, she let people come in and look at the machines and so forth. Yeah,
but that there may have been a little bit more.
Well,
mayhem.
There's also the judge wouldn't allow a lot of her stuff to be entered as evidence. They wouldn't allow any of her expert witnesses to speak. And there was two jurors who raised their hand before the sentencing and said they had found exculpatory evidence they would change their vote. And the judge didn't let that be heard either. So it's not a black and white deal.
Right.
It's just not.
It's just, but I'm sure, because I've seen it happen otherwise, when there is evidence that is, it holds water in court. We learn about that. I mean, the case in Northwest Iowa, where the election official, their spouse, changed 40 or so votes to go to their party, and that was caught.
It's a no-no. Absolutely.
It gives me some sense of confidence. Yeah.
But I don't have faith in the machines, Kai.
Well,
I'm not a Luddite, but I just don't have faith in the machines. I mean, there was an election 2 years ago. Luana, I'll forget her last name in a minute here, but she ran for state representative seat, and there was a call for a recount. And Diane Holst, former county supervisor, and Jim Hancock, longtime former supervisor, and Bill Davis, longtime county attorney, those three counted the votes, the actual ballots, three times. And there was all kinds of using the tabulator machines, and they got three different answers three times.
Well, we're going to run out of time here, Todd. But here's the thing. I mean, I don't know how you tabulate more than 150 million votes in aggregate. I mean, that's part of
being part of
a society. But I mean, how you do that without some assistance from machinery?
There's 100. They do it in where is it in Korea? I think no, it was Taiwan. They can count the ballots.
150 million of them?
No,
no.
And there's so 3,100 counties across America.
Right,
you have 31, and there's precincts in each county. How many votes come out in your precinct? Our precinct might get 250, 300 votes.
And there's checkpoints.
Decentralize it. Just everybody
all
count them in
the
their
way.
Precincts.
All along the way. Well, we're not going to solve it today.
No, probably
That's
not.
The thing.
Probably not.
But as ever, I appreciate Todd McGreevy for giving us stuff to think about. And I'm glad that you were able to spend some time here with us. And I hope you'll come back.
Thank you for being curious, Kai. I really appreciate it.
That should be our goal, I think, all day, every day. We've got to try to find ways to stay curious and pay attention. Because that's the other dangerous thing is you can slide into incuriousness by simply not paying attention anymore. So thank you, Todd McGreevy, the publisher of the River Cities Reader, also the head of Marigold Resources, which I understand a little bit better now, but I still got a ways to go. And friends, that's going to do it for this week. Todd, thank you once again.
Thank you, Kai.
All right. And friends, please keep in mind that the fun is not over yet on your public radio station. Our forecast, I handed it off to Todd, but I can tell you that today's high is going to get up around just shy of 60. It's going to be a gorgeous day. Get out and enjoy. Ahead on WVIK, it's Wait, Don't Tell Me. And be sure to join us next week when our guest will be Sam McCollum. from Steam on Wheels. And if you don't know what that is, you better tune in and find out right here. Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. You can find our podcast at WVIK.org or tune in to Quad Cities NPR, WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD in Rock Island, and at 95.9 FM, K240 DZ Dubuque. We're coming up on 11 o'clock, and we'll get a little news from National Public Radio in Washington on your NPR station, WVIK. Stay tuned. Please have a great week and come back and join us next week for all the fun on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded.